Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
For millions of years and millions of homes, a man loved a woman, a child it was born. It learned how to hurt and it learned how to cry like humans do.
That's David Byrne. And hold that name in your head, because we will talk about his creativity in just a minute, the Talking Heads frontman, and so much more. Byrne is one of the many examples of creative people in Jonah Lehrer's new book on creativity and where it comes from, drawing on his background in neuroscience. Jonah Lehrer, no relation, is a contributing editor at Wired and a frequent contributor to WNYC's Radio Lab and to The New Yorker, and now the author of Imagine: How Creativity Works. Hello, Jonah. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. A pleasure to be here.
And you have lots of great examples in this book of how the creative process works. There's the story of Pixar, for example, and how their offices were designed by Steve Jobs to get people interacting in places like the bathroom or around the water cooler. What does that tell us about the nature of creative thinking?
You know, it tells us that I think one of Jobs' geniuses was – he had some insights into how to manage the creative process. And one thing he realized is that when you're trying to manage a place like Pixar, which is all these different cultures, there are computer scientists, there are animators, there are editors, writers, directors, that the success of the studio would depend on all those cultures mixing, on computer scientists learning from animators and vice versa. So when he was designing the studio, the Pixar studio, he insisted that everyone share the same building. And so they had to renovate this old Del Monte canning factory. But he realized it wasn't enough to just be in the same building. You had to force people to mix and mingle. So he erected this big, vast, pretty atrium, started putting everything important in the atrium. He put the mailboxes there and the cafe and the coffee shop and the gift store. But he realized even that wasn't quite enough, because you could build people this beautiful cafeteria, but the computer scientists would still have lunch with computer scientists. So instead, his real insight was that there'd be only two bathrooms in this entire vast cavernous studio. Mm-hmm. And he put those bathrooms in the atrium as well. And at first, people thought this was so annoying, because they had to walk all the way to the other end of the building every time they needed to go to the bathroom. But now when you talk to people at Pixar, they all have their bathroom epiphany story. They talk about the great idea they had while washing their hands or while on the way to, you know, go to the bathroom.
But on the other hand, you write about how bad of an idea brainstorming is.
Yeah. So you know, if the insight of Jobs was to force people to interact, we also know that probably the most popular form of creative interaction, creative collaboration, is brainstorming. And brainstorming doesn't work. Brainstorming was invented by an ad man named Alex Osborne. He's the Don Draper of his day. And in a series of best-selling business books in the late 1940s, early 1950s, he outlined this technique called brainstorming, which has two simple rules. The first rule is, whatever you do, don't criticize. Second rule, it's all about quantity, not quality. And Osborne said, if you follow these two simple rules, that groups can just unleash the imagination. But scientists have known for decades that brainstorming doesn't work, that people who brainstorm actually come up with fewer new ideas than people who work on that same problem by themselves. Now, the reason brainstorming doesn't work is because of that first rule, is because it says don't criticize, the assumption being the imagination is very meek and shy and it'll just clam up if it's worried about being criticized. But the opposite turns out to be true. Studies by Charlene Namath at UC Berkeley have consistently shown that when groups engage in acts of debate and dissent, when they feel free to criticize each other, they actually come up with more ideas, and those ideas are rated as more original.
So, listeners, we know you're a creative bunch, and our phone lines are open to hear what you think about creativity and where it comes from. 212-433-WNYC, or to ask Jonah Lehrer about the science of it, as he reports in his new book, Imagine. 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. When you're inspired with a great idea or a creative solution to a problem, or when you're inspired in an artistic way, where does that creativity seem to originate for you? Is it inside of you? Is it outside of you? Is it when you're alone? Is it when you're with other people who you have creative resonance with? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So to stay on that point, it's not that groupness is bad. It's that the process of brainstorming as envisioned by that former madman is bad.
Yes. Groupness is often essential. I think, you know, there's some suggestive evidence from an economist named Ben Jones that creative collaborations are becoming more important. When you look at peer-reviewed papers published over the course of the 20th century, you find that 50 years ago, most of the most highly cited papers in a field were the product of a lone individual. Think Einstein, think Darwin, someone who all by themselves saw farther than the rest of us. They shifted the paradigm, just one person. But now when you look at the most highly cited papers in a field, those home run papers, they're almost always the product of a team. That seems to be because our problems are just getting harder, that all the low-hanging fruit is gone. So we either learn how to work together or fail alone. But that also means we have to learn how to work together effectively. And that's where I think brainstorming fails us. I think there's very good evidence at this point to, you know, to clearly show that, that brainstorming just isn't the most – it's not the best way to generate new ideas in a group. It can, you know, it makes us feel good. We all feel productive when we're in a brainstorming meeting because we can fill a whiteboard with our free associations and no one gets their feelings hurt. But creativity requires some trade-offs, and every once in a while that's going to involve some criticism.
The low-hanging fruit for individual creativity is gone, like the theory of relativity. That was so obvious. David Byrne, the former lead singer of Talking Heads, we played a clip, is an example in this book of the benefit of cities. And in his case, it's New York. And Jane Jacobs, the urban activist and author of The Death and Life of Great American Cities, who is also a New Yorker, makes the case for high density, what she referred to as knowledge spillovers. Is there a limit to that density? At a certain point, does that conflict with the benefits of being alone and relaxed on a long walk? Because some people go to the country to be creative.
Yeah. Well, that's why we have Central Park, right? You know, it's all about – to answer your first question, there doesn't seem to be a trade-off yet. We haven't found that peak density yet. So in the book, I talk about the work of Jeffrey West, who's a theoretical physicist at the Santa Fe Institute, who data mines cities. And his evidence suggests something very, very interesting, which is that as cities get bigger, and cities just keep on getting bigger, urbanization is the great theme of the 21st century, but as cities keep on getting bigger, everyone in that city becomes more productive. So when you live in a big city, when you move to an even bigger city, you're going to make more money, you're going to invent more patents, you're going to invent more trademarks. By every metric of productivity we have, people in big cities just look more productive. And that's because, as Jane Jacobs pointed out, there's something magical about the, you know, the friction of a city, about all those bumps, about the random interactions while waiting in line for a latte on the sidewalk. Every once in a while, some of those bumps, they add up to a good idea. So I don't think we've found peak density yet. I don't think we're living in cities that are too dense. But I also think, I mean, you're absolutely right. We need to also ensure that our cities have spaces for us to relax, that they have green spaces where we can go for a walk and not always be so stressed out and overwhelmed by those bumps of other people.
Desmond in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Jonah Lehrer. Hi, Desmond.
Hi. A question for you, and that is that I heard on WNYC a few months ago the idea that brainstorming can work, and in fact does work, if you use anonymous contributors. The group contributes via computers where no one hears their voice, no one knows who they are, and so that you're not afraid to profess an idea that you might think your boss would fire you for.
Yeah, and didn't you, Jonah, write about online brainstorming as something that sometimes works?
Well, in the book, I talk about a website called Innocentive, which isn't quite online brainstorming. It's more a form of crowdsourcing where people can anonymously contribute and help solve problems. And what that website shows is actually the benefits of outsider knowledge. That it's a website where big companies will post their impossible problems, companies like Procter & Gamble, General Electric. And what they found is that the people who solve these seemingly impossible problems, you know, let's say General Electric posts a chemistry problem, that problem's almost never solved by another chemist. Instead, it's solved by a molecular biologist or a biophysicist, someone who knows enough to understand the terms of the question but doesn't know so much they run into the exact same stumbling blocks as the expert scientist back at the big company. So I absolutely think there are ways to leverage collective creativity online, and I think we're just beginning to discover the potential of the internet for doing that. To get back to the question about the potential of brainstorming when we're not scared, you know, can we contribute anonymously? I think one of the larger problems with brainstorming is that Alex Osborne, the inventor of brainstorming, he assumed that our free associations, just the first ideas that come into our mind, that those are often really good ideas. And sadly, what the literature suggests is that's actually not the case. So if I ask you to free associate on the color blue, I can do a pretty good job of predicting your first answers. You'll probably say green, followed by ocean, followed by sky. And if you're feeling really creative this morning, you may say jeans, or maybe even Miles Davis. But most of our initial free associations are pretty banal. They're pretty predictable. And that's where dissent and criticism become essential. That's what forces us to dig a little bit deeper.
Bruce in Cranberry, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello.
So where does your creativity come from?
Well, in my line of work, and I've been an architect all my life, I seem to find that when you work at a problem, you gather all the ideas, and you work at it usually late in the evening. You go home, you have a good night rest, and usually in the first half of the next day, usually you find really interesting, creative solutions to your problem.
That's your experience, is sleeping on the idea and coming back to it the next day. Is there science to back that up?
There absolutely is. There's some really well-done research in which, and this is done by a variety of researchers, you give undergrads a variety of creative puzzles. And then you have three different conditions. One condition is no rest at all. They can't fall asleep. Second condition is they can fall asleep, but as soon as they fall into a deep sleep, as soon as they begin to enter REM sleep, where we actually engage in dreaming, you interrupt them. You wake them up. So it's actually a very unpleasant, you know, experiment control group to be in. The third condition is people are encouraged to fall asleep, to lapse into REM sleep. And then when they wake up, you have them solve the problems again. And what you discover is the people who engage in deep REM sleep, the kind of sleep described by the caller, they solve a lot more of the problems, anywhere between 20 to 50% more of the problems. So there is good evidence to suggest that when we're dreaming, when we're actually asleep, when we think our mind is turned off, our mind is actually trying to find new connections, trying to find those useful associations, then when we wake up in the morning and the problem's still there, we're more likely to find the answer.
But don't you also write that as we're falling asleep, when we're tired, or taking that hot shower at the end of the day, that those turn out to be particularly conducive moments for inspiration and creativity?
Yeah. In particular, they seem to be particularly good at when we need to solve a moment of insight, so when we're struggling with a really, really hard problem. And these kinds of problems are often solved in what are called moments of insight, when, you know, the epiphany just leaps into consciousness. We have this sudden flash of revelation. And those kinds of creative moments, those moments of insight, seem to be much more common when we're actually relaxed, when we're in the hot shower, when we're lying in bed early in the morning, half awake, half asleep, when we're going for a hike. That's a little bit counterintuitive, because I think most people assume that when you give them a really hard problem that they should chug caffeine, they should drink a triple espresso, they should do whatever it takes to stay focused, to concentrate, to chain themselves to their desk. But this science suggests that's the exact wrong approach, that we'll be focused, but we'll be focused on the wrong answer. Instead, we should take a break. The answer will only arrive once we stop looking for it.
Science writer Jonah Lehrer, no relation. You know him from Radiolab probably, and his new book is Imagine How Creativity Works. And Jamil and Piscataway are on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I was just calling to ask a question. Yesterday, you were on Fresh Air, and you were talking about some of the trends between writers and musicians with creativity and the need to walk away sometimes. But you also mentioned that there were some times where they were using different substances, substances that are often illegal now, or many of them are illegal now. And I was just curious if there's any trends between different personality affects and creativity. Which is to say, are there those that might be shy, those that might be quiet, those that might be dealing with depression, are they more inclined to be creative or to exhibit characteristics that are helpful in creative endeavors than those who are not?
Great question.
Great question. So this is a long-standing mystery in the field of creativity research, because when you give, you know, really successful creators a battery of personality tests. Let's say we could get Bob Dylan into a lab and give him a battery of personality test. Chances are he'd look pretty ordinary. He'd probably have a fairly normal IQ score. And according to most personality tests, like Myers-Briggs, he'd look like everyone else. He may be a little bit more open to experience. That is one of the correlations that pops out. But it's not a big effect. So for a long time, people haven't known what defines these kinds of epic creators, how we can predict in advance who's more likely to become, you know, a successful creative achiever. In recent years, scientists have made some interesting discoveries, however. They've, for instance, noticed that people who are distractible and have moderately high IQ scores, so people who may even suffer from ADD, that they are up to 7 times more likely to be eminent creative achievers in the real world. And that seems to be because, in this case, being a little distractible is actually a good thing, because you're always reaching for unexpected sources of information and then trying to combine that with the knowledge at hand. And most of the time, that'll be a waste of time. But every once in a while, that leads to a good new idea. So that's one surprising correlation they found. They've also, I think, begun to make sense of this longstanding finding that there does seem to be, and this is the work of Kay Redfield Jamison and others, there does seem to be a connection between certain kinds of depression, particularly bipolar depression, and creative achievement, especially among writers. And they've done this by looking at the biographies of, you know, British poets, for instance, and they found that British poets are anywhere between 7 and 40 times more likely to suffer from bipolar depression. It still remains unclear what's driving this correlation, but one leading theory is that it's because bipolar depression encapsulates the swings of the creative process. And, you know, of course, it can be a horrible, horrible mental illness.
Is it also just that you get creative when you get your manic phase going in bipolar?
Yeah, so that's part of it. So in the manic phase, you're filled with these feelings of euphoria. You can't help but create. You need to write all these ideas down. And then you slide into the horrible low of the depression, you know, that dismal, dreary feeling. And that phase seems to be better for editing. So scientists have shown that when people have low negative affect, one where you can induce these kinds of sad moods pretty quickly in a lab. You show people a 5-minute video about death and cancer, that people are better at persisting. They're more stubborn. They're less likely to quit.
It explains the personalities of several editors I've known in my journalism career. But what about the substances that Jamil mentions? When people are high on certain drugs or alcohol, do they get more creative inspiration, or do they just think they do and wake up in the morning and go, boy, that was a stoned insight. That definitely doesn't pan out.
Well, that definitely happens too, but there is good evidence to suggest that certain substances can make us better at various kinds of creative problem solving. So just last month, a study showed that when you get undergraduates legally drunk, so not just one beer, these are several beers, they solve 30% more creative problems that require insights. And that's in part because they seem to be more relaxed. They're more likely to daydream, and daydreaming is a very productive mental state. Other studies have looked at marijuana, which gives you similar boosts. And then, of course, there's this other kind of creativity, which is when we need to focus, you know, when it actually helps to be a little bit melancholy and sad, you know, when we need to go through draft after draft. That's not, you know, it's not as romantic as when we have the epiphany in the shower, but it's often just as necessary. And, of course, there are drugs that help with that phase of creativity, too. That's why so many writers have taken various kinds of amphetamines, such as Benzedrine. Which, of course, comes with horrible side effects. All these drugs, you know, have real downsides, which is why we shouldn't recommend them for everyday use. But creativity is just so hard. It's so difficult to come up with something new that I think creators and inventors have always searched for every possible edge.
So here's a follow-up question from Jesse on our webpage, who writes, I'm very intrigued by Jonah's writing on marijuana and divergent thinking. I'm in a creative field, and I've had success combining the two. Is there a way to learn to tap into the same type of benefit without using cannabis?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think one could begin by finding a way to just get better at relaxation. Find, you know, get better at finding a spot that puts your mind at ease. You know, whether it's a hot shower, for me, it's taking a long walk and leaving my phone behind. Find that spot, find that place that allows you to not worry about work. This is a great line of Einstein's where he said, creativity is the residue of time wasted. So find that place that just allows you to completely waste time.
We're almost out of time. I want to get to a couple of more things. Age and creativity. We had the portrait photographer Annie Leibovitz on the program a few months ago to talk about her book Pilgrimage, which is a collection of photographs of places, not people, different for Annie Leibovitz. And as she was coming into the studio before the interview, she told me that old age gets a bum rap. Mm-hmm. So I asked what she meant.
You can have talent, but it can go away. And it's I've said this before, but it's like a big baby, and you have to take care of it. You have to nurture it. You have to feed it. And that is what this project is feeding, you know, my mind and my soul and my heart so that I can go back and take better portraits.
So this brings me to a question that I've wondered about a lot, and I've asked it on the air several times, listeners may recognize it. Some of my biggest musical heroes, like Miles Davis, who you mentioned before, and Beethoven, are the ones who keep evolving as they age. Beethoven's Ninth was just a better, deeper work than Beethoven's First, based on some kind of continued creative growth and the life experience that feeds into it. But so many musicians have a burst of creativity when they're young. Then they go on oldies tours the rest of the life, or their lives, or, you know, just right in a very narrow range. Does something explain this?
Yeah. So psychologists such as Dean Simonton at UC Davis, they've looked at, you know, vast numbers of biographies. And what's that allowed them to come up with is what they call the peak age of creativity, which turns out in different fields, there are different peak ages. So if you're a physicist or a poet, turns out your peak age of creativity on average is going to come pretty early in your career, probably in your late 20s, early 30s. If you're a molecular biologist, it may be in your late 30s. If you're a historian, it may be in your early 50s. And that depends on just how much information you have to master before you can come up with a useful new connection. And for a long time, scientists assumed that the best way to explain these peak ages of creativity was that the imagination, a bit like long-term memory, just kind of falls apart over time. It's a very depressing conclusion, that there's something inevitable about the loss of our creativity as we got older. But that no longer seems to be the case. And that's in large part because of examples like Miles Davis, like Bob Dylan, like Beethoven, like Pablo Picasso, like Paul Erdős, these guys who throughout their entire career remained incredibly innovative, incredibly creative. And now the thinking is that what actually explains that peak age, so the fact that we peak very early in our careers in terms of creative output and then slowly decline for the next few decades, that actually has to do with what psychologists refer to as enculturation, that people just become invested in the status quo. They become used to shooting photographs in a certain way or playing the same melody, thinking about music in the same way. And that's why the those rare souls who are able to stay creative for their entire careers, they tend to try different things. They tend to constantly reinvent themselves. And it's that active reinvention that keeps us creative.
And that's where we will have to leave it. I could talk about this all day, and obviously our listeners could too. So we will have to have you back. And listeners, you can keep the conversation going creatively, no doubt, on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. My guest has been Jonah Lehrer, no relation, a contributing editor at Wired, and as many of you know, a frequent contributor to WNYC's Radiolab, also to The New Yorker. He has now written Imagine How Creativity Works. Thanks, Jonah.
Thank you.
And we'll end with a little more David Byrne, this time with the Talking Heads. This is Life During Wartime, because coming up after the break, a discussion on war in popular culture. Stay with us.